3:05, welcome to the Monday Committee on Environment and Energy meeting. We have a quorum for business. We're joined by Legislator Maizano and Legislator Myers, and we expect a few more to be joining us shortly. We have a couple of items of business today. One is a letter of support for Assemblywoman Paulin's bill, which is going around for signature. This deals with parity between county penalties versus state penalties for enforcement of oil tank regulations. And in light of the recent spill, we think it's important that the county have the same ability to enforce as the state. We have two pieces of business today. One is our good friends from Cornell Cooperative Extension are here to give us an update. And we'll get to that in 1 second. The second piece of business that's not formally on the agenda but is on the agenda is the comment period for the PSC hearing. Chris Crane has been drafting comments for the committee. And as you recall, Legislator Rogowski and I and Chris and Stu went down, and we had a very, very productive meeting with them about the vegetation management plan, and they very much wanted us to submit these comments. So the comments are due on Wednesday, so either in the course of this meeting at the end we can take 5 minutes and look at them, or you can read them overnight, and if you have comments, get them to Chris. So that'll be the second part of the meeting, but we don't want to delay any further. So Barbara, why don't you and your team identify yourselves for the record, just so we can hear it on the tape. Give us your presentation, and then we'll field questions.
Okay, great. My name is Barbara Sachs. I'm the Executive Director of Cornell Cooperative Extension. We're right up the road here in Valhalla. And with me is Rick Harper from our horticulture staff. He's also our integrated pest management specialist. And I'd like to start by saying thank you. Thank you not just for inviting us today, but also for the continued support that you've given us over the years. We really appreciate it. I don't know if you know how Extension works, but the reason why it's so important that we get a county appropriation is because County Law 224 that established us through the state legislature says that a county can have an extension office if it makes the appropriation. Then if it makes the appropriation, the state then kicks in its funding, and Cornell kicks in its resources, the federal funds flow, and that's how you have a program. So, you know, what has to trigger it, though, is the county appropriation, thus our eternal gratitude for your continued support. We do quite a bit in the way of environmental work, and what we do is fairly unique. We're educators, so we take the land-grant mission and do our teaching according to the needs of the local community. Our Westchester program is not like anyone else's in the state because we respond to local needs. There's a general template, but what we do depends on what our community needs. We do our environmental activities by teaching people best practices. And by best practices, I mean those which are the most environmentally friendly. So we also do a lot of research right down here in Westchester. Rick is going to talk a little bit about that later. And that is geared strictly toward people who have property and issues down here. We work to some degree at Hilltop Hanover Farm. We also go out to farmers markets. We have demonstration gardens right here in Hartsbrook Preserve. We have a nutrition program, which is probably one of the best in the county, but of course you can understand my bias, where we teach nutrition education to food stamp eligible adults and teach them how to stretch the food stamp dollar. Part of that, of course, includes our effort to prevent youth obesity, which is a growing problem, and particularly in this part of the state. We also do a lot of youth programs. We do them through 4-H and through the schools. One of the newer, exciting programs that we've gotten involved in is school gardening, and we are teaching youngsters in, I think we've got now 56 schools trained, how to grow their own vegetables at school And we're working into that the science lesson, as well as a little, you know, plant biology and nutrition, because the studies have shown that kids will eat anything if they grow it themselves. So these school gardens are really, you know, our subtle way of getting the children to eat healthier. And, you know, why is this so important? The populations with whom we deal tend to be very limited income. They do not have private health insurance, so if there is illness, that has to be treated at the public taxpayers' expense. And if we can reduce what the taxpayers have to support later on, you know, that's a good investment of our time and our effort. So, you know, part of our youth programs and our nutrition programs are designed to do exactly that. We also have, I guess you probably know, you know, or have children or grandchildren who have come home from school and said, we hatch chick eggs or duck eggs in the classroom. That's a very large program of ours also. Last year, over 9,000 Westchester youngsters participated in that program. And again, we're teaching them an appreciation for the life cycle. We're teaching them sensitivity to the environment. And, you know, we're also teaching them to have an understanding of what animals and wildlife and non-humans, you know, coexist with us, have needs for. We are public employees. We're not actually the university. We are established, again, through County Law 224 as a governmental agency. So that means that we have a very public mission, and part of our public mission is to serve the local needs. Now, I did mention that our local needs tend to be different from those in the rest of the state. We have, for instance, as Rick is going to explain, the largest turf and landscape industry and the largest golf course industry in the entire state. So it behooves us to do as much economic development with them and to see that they remain viable, because they hire thousands and thousands of people in Westchester. So, you know, it's a substantial payroll. That's one of the things that we feel is our mission here. Nowhere else in the state are they doing that, because they don't have that need. We have master gardeners who are going into the community and doing site visits. Again, you know, that's something that's very special and unique to Westchester. In fact, last year, our master gardeners provided over 6,700 hours of volunteer service, and they reached 5,694 residents. So that's a lot of people who are impacted by our programs. And by the way, the master gardener demonstration garden at Hartsbrook, where we grow vegetables and we train people in community gardening and vegetable growing. Last year, they donated over a ton of vegetables to the pantry at Grace Church, the food pantry. So, you know, that's what we do with our vegetables. We've got a lot of programs. You've probably heard of the 4-H clubs, and I guess you know about the fair, the Grange Fair. We have a substantial role in that. When Muskoot had its annual fair, we had a substantial role there too, but Muskoot is cutting back year by year. So that's who we are, and I guess I'll open it to questions. There are some handouts here. I don't know if you...
While we're getting those, just for the record, we've been joined by Legislator Testa. Do you want to go ahead and do your PowerPoint on the screen, and then we'll...
Sure.
Maybe go to everybody for questions for both of you.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, everybody, feel free to take your jackets off. It's a little warm in here. We don't stand on formality.
It is a little warm. Yes. Okay. Well, it's good to be here today. Thanks for your time. I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the specific things that we've been involved in, and we'll just end with a few general things. Barbara's covered quite a bit of it, of course. It's great to be here. And, of course, one of the things I want to mention, and many of you, of course, are already familiar with this, we provided the educational support as it related to the fertilizer legislation that was so widely discussed last year. And, of course, I remember some of the hearings in this very room. And so, of course, out of that came a bilingual DVD that's produced in English and in Spanish. So that was actually, I was just actually talking to the folks at the Consumer Protection last week. They feel that the estimate was somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 copies that were
printed, they've handed out.
That they've sent out.
Whoa.
Yes. And we continue to get requests about that too at the office from contractors and things like that. So as Barbara said, in terms of economic development, I mean, this is a key thing where we're serving small business here in Westchester County. And of course, we had one public outreach seminar that the county had approved last year that was hosted by the Turf and Landscape Association on September 22nd. So we had to be a part of, we were part of that effort. So this is sort of one thing. The other thing, of course, that we're familiar with, and sometimes I see you folks, as I'm on my way to a pest management committee meeting at the end of the month up here on this floor, is that I not only do a couple secretarial duties, including taking the minutes, but I sit as technical advisor to the Westchester County Pest Management Committee and have been there since the inception of, since I've been in my position. You can see I copied this off of an old letterhead. This is dated October 2000. I found an old pest management committee letterhead in my office, and that's a few months just before I started, but essentially you folks are familiar with the committee, and our role in the committee is sort of like our role on any other organization. That is to draw from the resources of Cornell University. In this particular instance, it's to provide least toxic, integrated, and non-chemical pest management options to the county, not only to the county committee members, but also, of course, to the different departments in Westchester County. And that sort of takes me to my next item right here. As a technical advisor to that committee, one of my responsibilities is to produce an annual professional development program for golf course employees, because we all know golf courses were sort of a hot button issue as it relates to pests and pest management. And so for the last, I think it's been, this would be the eighth one, this would be the eighth seminar. So I started the following year after I started in my position putting this together. But we basically put together a morning program, and as Barbara said, we're just up the road in Valhalla. I'm not an editorial person. I titled it Managing Golf Courses for Today's Consumer and Tomorrow's Environment. I'm a science guy, but that's the title I've been using for years. It's not bad. It's somewhat catchy, I suppose. But anyways, we get lecturers and faculty from Cornell University and actually representatives from other universities as well. And these are just a few of the speakers that we've had come down, and we're going to have Dr. Dan Peck again come down from Cornell University, and Dr. Tamsin Ye, she'll be joining us again this year from the Cooperative Extension Office in Suffolk County. She's a specialist out there working with turf grass. And, you know, a couple of things I want to mention is that I think that this is really, at least as far as I know, this is the only select educational opportunity that the golf course folks get, the employees on the golf courses really get, in terms of some sort of formal education, some sort of formal training, this morning program that we do annually.
Can you send Chris a notice? There's Chris. When that event is?
Yes.
Because I think some of us would be interested in attending that, especially in light of the fact that, you know, the phosphorus legislation is going to be going into effect early next year.
Yep.
And we had great input from the golf folks and from the turf and landscape folks. So I think, one, we'd love to hear what you have to see, but two, I think it'd be important for them to see that we are following up and we're staying in the loop. So we'd greatly appreciate that.
Sure, yeah. I actually just handed out the draft agenda at the last Pest Management Committee meeting. Did you get it, Chris? Did I hand it to you?
I attended, but I'll misplace it.
Sure, I can email that to you. Okay. No, not a problem. It's going to be on the 19th of October. We usually have it right around that time of the year. And the one thing I also want to mention, if I may, is that, you know, for any one of these speakers, and some of these folks go out to private organizations and do this, and you know, they can charge upwards of, in terms of a speaking fee, because they are such renowned experts, they can charge upwards of $10,000 a day. We're able to bring these people in at essentially no cost to the folks that work at the county golf course. And so there's obviously a substantial monetary benefit there as well. And I mentioned that this is Dan Peck right here. I mentioned that Dan is coming down this year as one of the guest speakers. Well, one of the things I want to mention is, of course, we're all familiar with healthy turf cover and the benefits associated with that in terms of mitigating stormwater runoff and preventing erosion and sequestering carbon and producing oxygen. One of the most pernicious pests on a golf course that's going to help to, it's going to try to stop the occurrence of a healthy turf environment is, of course, the annual bluegrass weevil. It's probably the single most problematic insect on a golf course. And you can see this weevil right here. It's a picture of the weevil right here. And they're one of the main diagnostic features of weevils is that they feature this kind of a snout right here. Gonzo was actually a weevil from the Muppets, if you guys ever watched the Muppets. She actually was. But anyway, this is where my wife calls me a nerd. So we've actually been involved in a couple years of research with Dan, helping out with setting up the site and collecting samples. One of the purposes behind this research was to better understand the life cycle of annual bluegrass weevil. It's really sort of groundbreaking work that Dan's been doing and a couple of other researchers. And of course, the point to this is to help people better manage them, to help the golf course professionals better manage these insects so that they can reduce the amount of insecticides used to managing this particular problematic insect. So here we are collecting cores. This is Jerry Giordano, a colleague of mine in our program area. So this is in 2008. We're out collecting plugs. You can see these plugs that we're pulling are sort of the size of a hockey puck right here. Dan's holding some as well. And what we do is we take these plugs, collect them in the field from certain sites throughout the year, bring them back to the office. This is a dehumidifier. Boy, the things that entomologists dream up, right? This is a dehumidifier right here. We've taken these plugs, and Barbara remembers because we always occupied the boardroom once a week every morning flipping these plugs over. We flip them over and they get dried out. They get desiccated from the dehumidifier. The insects then that are in the turf, in the grass, drop out into these sticky traps and we mail these up to campus. So that's how they count the insect populations. We also covered it with a shower curtain to sort of help the drying process. But as I said, it's certainly a pernicious insect. But another area of research that we've been involved in recently is we've been doing some perennial ryegrass overseeding. We did this for 3 years, 2006, 2007, 2008. Out at Fox Meadows Elementary School. This was under the direction of Dr. Frank Rossi on campus and David Chinnery, one of our colleagues up in the Capital Region. He's a turf grass specialist. And the whole point to doing this was maintaining turf coverage while reducing the amount of pesticides and fertilizers we needed. And essentially what we were doing is we were going out weekly at different rates, and you can actually see this strip right here. We were going out weekly at different rates delivering ryegrass onto the turf area to encourage germination. No pesticides, no fertilizers, no irrigation, just Mother Nature with the amount of rainfall that we had. And we were able to find that after 3 years, we ended up with 86% turf cover. Turf is just, I just use that word as a replacement for grass. 86% turf cover, seeding at 6 pounds per 1,000 square feet, versus the control, the unseeded control, where we had less than half, 49% turf cover. Of course, that's important for a number of issues, including liability. Everybody's afraid of their children, spraining their ankles, breaking ankles, things like that, and poor turf cover is directly associated with that. So this is a great non-chemical way of encouraging turf, the presence of turf. The nice thing about this is the way this has been able to translate for us to regular homeowners is that we often get the question every spring, I want to control my crabgrass, but I don't want to use some sort of a herbicide. Do you have any sort of an option? Well, the nice thing that we can do is we can sort of say, well, you know what, if you go out even in the spring of the year, we don't have any formal data on this, but we do certainly on our fall overseeding. In the spring of the year, if you go out with repeated overseeding with something like perennial ryegrass, which germinates very quickly, the chance of you out-competing the crabgrass before it actually appears is greater. So we now have a tool, again, a non-chemical tool that we can recommend to people and in the face of it if they want to reduce herbicide use on their home lawns. Okay, last item of research. We've got a hemlock trial up at Lasdon Park and Arboretum. As you can see, we cooperate with a number of different county facilities in terms of our golf course work. It was out at Dunwoody and Maple Moor, and we spent a lot of time up at Lasdon Park and Arboretum. And under the direction of a couple of specialists from campus, Dr. Paul Weston's no longer in the system, now it's Dr. Elizabeth Lamb, we've actually published in a scientific journal some information about the resistance potential of hemlocks from all over the world, as well as a few different species that grow here in the United States that may be resistant to hemlock willy adelgid. Unfortunately, most of us are familiar with hemlock willy adelgid. You go out into your yard and turn over your needles, and this is probably what you're going to see. And we've certainly seen some high populations this year because we had a fairly warm winter January is usually our coldest month, and January is 2 to 4 degrees above normal this year, so that can really encourage overwintering insects. So we have a trial with 7 different types of species of hemlocks. You can see a few of them growing here that we're looking at for resistance potential. And the most promising species that we've identified so far, it actually looks somewhat similar to an eastern hemlock. We believe it's entirely resistant to hemlock woolly adelgid, and that is Chinese hemlock, Suga chinensis. That leads us, of course, to a whole other number of issues, like we can't really encourage the planting of Chinese hemlock yet in people's properties because, well, what if it's invasive, right? That needs to be looked at. Availability, that needs to be looked at. We're seeing populations of other insects on it. So that all needs to be looked at. Research begets more research, right? But certainly we're working hard. And in terms of up at Lasin, I did just want to include this. We actually did a tree walk up there looking at some flowering trees. This is one of the lilacs. This is Syringa reticulata, the Japanese tree lilac. So we did a tree walk for them, for the Audubon folks up there, a little bit earlier this month. And it's always nice to cooperate with a number of different groups. Okay, and in terms of timely publications that we're involved in, just as I wrap up here, and I did bring a few copies of these, we're involved in the production of something called Hudson Valley Horticulture. This goes out to 600 to 700 green industry professionals here in Westchester County, probably upwards of 1,000 here in the lower Hudson Valley, because this is put together with myself and other colleagues from other extension offices. We write articles and site research and advertise programs and things like that. There's a weekly turf newsletter that I'm involved with in terms of reporting what's going on. This is Shortcut, produced by Dr. Frank Rossi for turf professionals. And Branching Out, I brought a few copies of this as well. This is for arborists. It identifies insect and disease presence and those types of things. And like I said, the objective of these things, it's sort of similar to our overall objective, which is to deliver research-based, environmentally responsible, best management practices, as Barbara identified, to green industry and ag professionals throughout Westchester and New York. Just a list of some of our select cooperators: Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Agriculture, DEP folks, Environmental Protection folks, Forest Service folks. All these people were able to bring to the county and cooperate with on a number of items. And of course, representatives from municipalities throughout the county. And many of us, we have a great key program, the Certified Tree Steward Program, where we've trained people from different municipalities. We actually just had, and Chris was mentioning to me this to me earlier, we just had a municipal tree forum on Friday out at Greenberg, where we had about 50 individuals, a number of them planners and managers and employees of different municipalities here in Westchester County. Our basic gist is to help people maximize the trees, the survival of their trees in their community with minimal inputs, pesticides and fertilizers and things like that, sort of implementing some of those best management practices Barbara touched on, so that we can enable those communities to save dollars in terms of replacement of trees and things like that. And of course we do that by delivering information about proper planting practices, proper selection, those types of things. Some other organizations that are not governmental that we cooperate with. I know this is a hot button organization right now, but we cooperate with the folks and train the folks at Con Ed in terms of identifying best pruning practices. The folks at Audubon, both Audubon International, and this is just the standard Audubon that we're familiar with, the Watershed Agriculture Council, and of course we're all familiar here with the local New York State Turf and Landscape Association, where we help them put on their big trade show in terms of the educational component, where there are about 400 to 500 attendees. This is known as the billion-dollar industry here in Westchester County, the green industry in general, golf courses, landscapers, arborists, that sort of thing. And we have generally about 14 concurrent educational seminars where we have what we would like to say is the best and the brightest from the research world delivering those IPM practices to
Can I ask you a question? How do you calculate that billion-dollar figure?
That's a term that I've heard that's been thrown around since I've started in my position for the last 10 years. So
that came from the industry. And if you look at, for instance, just the turf and landscape industry, they've got a payroll of an annual payroll of over $100 million. That's a lot of money just for that industry. That's sure. Not including the golf course or the nurseries, or any of the garden supply stores. So it's big business here.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. This is one of my last slides. This is just a few signature programs here that we're involved in. And this, of course, I mentioned earlier, our Certified Tree Steward program. So I have the joy of living out my passion, which is trees and the environment, and I get a chance to sort of communicate that hopefully that enthusiasm and a little bit of that knowledge to some of the other professionals and some of the other communities, as well as, again, many of the industries that we work with. And, of course, our 150 Master Gardeners. Many of us here are familiar with our Master Gardener program that Barbara already touched on. We've done quite a bit of work with school gardening as well, which Barbara already touched on as well. And just allow me to summarize, in terms of our signature services, while we continue, of course, to get just a wide number of consumer and commercial call-ins for horticulture and environmental related issues. And, you know, it's been interesting as the economy has sort of taken that turn over the last year and a half, we've continued to get more and more people using our services. This year we figure, it's still a little early yet because it's only June, but we figure that's up about 40% this year. So obviously I think the reason is pretty straightforward. People are trying to grow their own food and care for their own properties now. Even here, things like Sears is selling out of lawnmowers quicker than they ever have, right? Because people want to do those types of things themselves. And of course, we run a diagnostic clinic, a laboratory where people bring in samples and diseases, plants, insects. We get into the area of invasives quite a bit as well. And we also, probably the most enjoyable part of my job, in addition to all that fun research, is we get to go out and do site visits. We do site visits as a service to the industry, to generally small business owners, and help them implement best management practices on site. And this is something we've been getting a call of a lot this year. If you turn over your plants, you might see this cottony substance on the back of your plants. It's probably one of the cottony scales. It's cottony taxus scale, cottony maple scale, cottony maple leaf scale. And the big thing to do with this is probably nothing. It's probably, you know, populations of scale insects ebb and flow depending on the environment, depending on the health of your plants, depending on the presence of natural enemies. And we're just at a peak time right now. So if you probably have a healthy plant and it doesn't have feature too high of an infestation, it's probably going to be fine. And you can actually see I've teased this one open here to take a look at the eggs. That's the female right there. She's just finished laying her eggs. She'll then die, and the crawlers will then hatch. So if somebody felt that they really did need to do something, to take some sort of an action, like they had a prize plant or the populations were very high on a plant, then we would recommend something like maybe an oil or a soap treatment to do this. And then the timing would be whenever those crawlers hatch, which should be right about now. We got a little bit of a weird growing season going on. We're about 2 weeks or so ahead of time. Just one thing that we've been getting a lot of calls of.
Rick mentioned we have a lab at our headquarters in Valhalla. And we also staff the hotline and the phones. And last year, we responded to 1,600 requests for help from homeowners as well as the industry, mostly from homeowners. And the interesting thing is that was 50% more than our norm. So when we say we're running 40% ahead, you know, we're almost round the clock with those phones and with the walk-ins. We also, we don't just help people in the industry and homeowners. We get a lot of tenants who call and have problems with, for instance, urban bed bugs, cockroaches, rodents, things like that. So they want to know the best way to control the problem, and we give them our best advice without having them, inundate themselves with a lot of chemicals. So we basically serve the entire spectrum, you know, residential tenant as well as homeowner as well as landlord, all the way through to business owners and superintendents of golf courses.
All right, well, thank you. I noticed for the record, just note for the record, we're joined by Legislator Kaplowitz. I have a couple of questions and then open it up to other members. Thank you both. The first is, you know, you're talking about an increase in demand for your services, and yet you've had a budget cut, as lots of folks have had budget cuts. Tell us what the percent was, what the dollar amount was, and what impact that's had on your ability to deliver services in light of the fact that you're saying you're busier now than you've ever been.
Well, we had a 10% cut in the 2010 appropriation from the county. That translated into $130,000 less from the county. However, because we use the county dollars to leverage other dollars, state and federal funds as well as Cornell resources, it actually had a two- or three-fold effect, so our real loss was closer to $390,000.
All right, so for every dollar of county money you lose, you then lose state and federal money.
And Cornell resources, too. And Cornell provides, you know, it's like the, what do you call it, fringe benefits, you know, and the payroll-related
items. So it's state, federal, and Cornell you lose.
Right.
In leveraging funds.
Right. So, you know, it hurt us, and I'll tell you exactly where we did cut. We had to cut out our science in the schools program. We had a wonderful team that went into the schools and did what we called a science roadshow. And they showed kids how to enjoy science in a way that we're not teaching to the regents, we're not teaching to any test. And out of that, we had such a reception. We started out with classes of maybe 20 students, and then the next thing we knew, the principal would call us back and have a whole assembly devoted to our program. So we had to discontinue that. We were doing a youth nutrition program with some of the community organizations, and some of that was an after-school program where we were teaching the youngsters, you know, good health habits, good eating habits, exercise. So we had to cut that out. We also reduced the amount of services that we could devote to things like Conservation Day. That's where we bring schools from all over the county up to Hilltop Hanover, and they go from station to station learning different things about conservation and the environment. We lost one nutrition educator, which really meant that we were losing that grant. So, you know, those were our losses. We're still doing many, many other things, and our big youth programs like incubation and embryology that reaches over 9,000 youngsters a year, that we're still doing. But, you know, I'm not going to say the cuts didn't hurt. They did hurt. So, well, we've also been relying and really pressing our volunteers. We have hundreds of volunteers, and we've just been, you know, bringing them into areas where they constantly say to us, "Well, we never dreamed when we signed up as a volunteer that we'd be doing this." But you know, we promise them it's temporary till the economy turns around. They've been helping us, and we team up with other organizations. For instance, with youth nutrition. This morning, we set the groundwork in place to team up with Blythedale Hospital because they have a program where they go into the schools and teach the nutrition to youngsters K through 8. And we have school gardens in those schools, so we like to tie the two together. And that way the kids are learning the importance of the vegetable that they're growing and how to prepare it, and, you know, for an after-school snack instead of reaching for a bag of chips. So we're relying more on partnerships. We do have a lot of partnerships around the county. I guess over 200 organizations partner with us. But like I said, the cuts did hurt.
Is there a charge for your lab services? So say I wanted to bring you a chunk of turf or a water sample. Do you charge for that?
Only if we have to send it someplace. If we can do it right there. So if you bring us an insect and we look under the microscope, you know, that's fine, you know.
So that's a service you provide free.
Yes, but if we have to recommend, for instance, a soil test kit, then we just give it to you at the price that we pay. There's no, we don't make anything on that, you know, it's a pass-through. So.
Let me ask you another question along this vein. You know, next year is when the phosphorus legislation goes into effect. It's 2011, and this is the year that the inventory is cycling out. But this is also the year that the education component is most critical. So next year, so when people are ordering stock for next year, they're not ordering phosphorus fertilizer. And then when it comes time to apply in the spring, and we wrote you into the law specifically for your expertise. Do you have the resources? I know you talked about the number of DVDs you produced. Do you have enough resources to see that you're carrying out that mission?
We do, and the way we're doing it is, you know, the I think the reference was to under 2,000 DVDs were sent out, and the county actually created that. They paid for it. We did the show, but they filmed it and produced the DVD. We also have in our office a station where anybody who needs the training can come in and get it and just sit down. There's no charge for that. We've also made sure that through the industries that are affected, they know that we have the resources, and that if they have not been trained and if they have not gotten up to speed, all they need to do is contact us, and they did. And so we're way ahead of that. In other words, there should be no excuse for anybody to do something foolish with phosphorus out there on some property and claim that they have a lack of knowledge. If they're commercial, they should have the knowledge by now. The DVD is very good because it's bilingual. And the people who work for a contractor this year might not be there next year. So this way, the contractor has a copy of that DVD. If they want to play it themselves at their place of business, that's fine. If they want to come into our office and play it, that's fine. They can bring their employees in, and the employee can learn soup to nuts, everything that you need to know to comply with the law. So ignorance would not be an excuse for non-compliance.
Can we get a copy of that, Chris? Do we have a copy of
the
that?
The DVD?
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to get a copy. I might have it somewhere. But
all right, that'd be interesting, because we just, as you know, we spent close to a year on that yeah. legislation. Yeah. So, yeah. It, you know, for those of us who represent the watershed, you know, where we're under consent order for TMDLs, that's hugely important. So
that's a great resource. You know, we deal with other counties that have a similar type of legislation. They don't, their county didn't produce a DVD for them, and you can see it's really much more challenging. And we're very blessed to be in that situation to say, you know, you really need to avail yourself of this, and that's essentially it.
I think consumer protection has a whole staff of them downstairs, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I just have two more questions, and then we'll open it up to colleagues. One is on the Pest Management Committee, in which you serve, and mm-hmm. Cornell Cooperative Extension is a technical advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Would you just go into a little more detail on your role with them, gauge your success on their ability to reduce the county's dependence on pesticides and herbicides?
Well, I mean, in terms of success, that's going to be one of the good things that's really happened over the last year is that there was the hiring of the pest management coordinator, Kevin Hurley, and he did a great job of collecting a lot of data that was really sort of out there lying around. You know, the committee is a committee of volunteers, and he's done a really good job of putting that together over the first year. So it's sort of, I think the committee's really at a real opportunity now where they want to start quantifying what's really going on in terms of reduction, pesticide use, and things like that. I mean, my role in the committee, it's quite similar to a role in really any other organization that we sit, is to really try to bring the knowledge at Cornell University to the committee. So, for example, I mean, we deal quite often with, with annual bluegrass weevil, in terms of how to manage annual bluegrass weevil. If there were some chemicals being discussed, and this actually happened at the last meeting, you know, one of the things that I can certainly do is to offer our knowledge in terms of what type of chemical could be used that is least toxic. And if there's questions that I can't answer, it's certainly to take them back to the professors on campus and sort of act as a bit of a conduit between the two, if you will. So that's some of the things that we're involved in. The other thing is, you know, think we get questions, boy, things like deer repellents, identifying least toxic deer repellents and things like that. You know, I've gone ahead and put together lists over the years of certain types of products that can be used for those types of pests. So it's in many ways acting as a conduit between the university and the committee. And like I said, taking the minutes, which I'm happy to do.
Members.
Yes.
Coyote.
Well, I was at we had a public forum last June.
Got a lot of them.
Where Dan Bogan.
Yeah, they're coming down to our area.
Yeah, he came down from Cornell University and gave a public seminar on coyotes and talked a little bit about some of the different habits. And the populations certainly are on the increase.
Yeah.
People know that.
I mean, I saw one trotting along a sidewalk the other day. And this is in Larchmont.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
Wiley?
Maybe.
It's something that we're continuing to get more and more questions about, coyotes, and you know, some people link that with the increased deer populations that we have here in
Do
West
coyote
Chester
eat
counties.
Deer?
Well, they'll sort of forage on a lame or even a dead animal. They don't tend to be primary hunters in that regard, but if that opportunity is there, and certainly it's there more and more, you know, from car strikes and things like
yeah.
that, just because we have such high deer populations here in Westchester County. So, you know, the other part is I would like to say, you know, and this comes from our conversations with both Dan, who is Dr. Paul Curtis's grad student up on campus. He's a wildlife specialist. The other thing, too, is that, you know, some of the media attention that coyotes have gotten have people, you know, under the notion that it's a very prevalent problem. And the reality is, according to Paul and Dan, you know, Dr. Curtis and Dan, is that your chances of still being attacked by like a local neighboring dog or your own dog or something like that are still significantly higher. So my point isn't to say that the coyote certainly can't be an issue, but it's to try to put in a little bit of perspective. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I think people, especially in the more suburban areas, are worried about the coyote coming after their pets,
yes,
their dogs.
Sure. And I have two young kids, sure, and even children. I understand that, sure.
More of a statement than a question. I just want to thank Barbara and the entire staff. I've had the pleasure of serving on the board as the board legislative liaison. Certainly, if anybody else would like to share in that pleasure as a legislator, just let me know. I'd be happy to help have others also sit in, because you learn a lot, and the board runs well. Barbara, to her credit, and the entire staff does a good job, and with diminished resources, you know, it's the reality. It's in some ways the model, unfortunately, of what we might see this, you know, this coming year through the year, and certain groups can do and certain groups can't. And, you know, certain groups are more dependent on more critical, you know, food, housing, shelter. I mean, it's hard to, you know, but yet Cornell, I think, needs credit, and Barbara too, and the entire staff for working under a tough situation, and the programs that they've delivered countywide are great, and then to the district, you know, 4-H and you know, what they've done historically. Participation in Hilltop Hanover, you know, has been productive, and so it would be nice to get them back someday to where they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So continue to do their mission, but I fear we, you know, we're all in for a little bit of difficult time before we can get back to that point. So not quite a mea culpa or an apologia, but I guess that's kind of what you know, we're all going to be engaged in. So.
And to your point, Legislator Kaplowitz, one of the things that we discussed right before you got here was the $130,000 budget cut from us equated in reality to a $300,000 to them. So I think we all need to be vigilant when we come to budget time. As you said, we're going to have to make some tough choices and tough priorities, but we've got to understand that when it comes to leveraging funds, and we see this, you know, with health department, probation, you know, we see this across our budget, that when we cut leveraged funds, you know, we might be in the position of being penny wise and pound foolish. So we've got to recognize that and hope as we get closer to that cycle, you'll keep us posted. Any other questions on, or do you have anything else?
Well, our county budget really, if we put it in the perspective of how much service we give to the community, it costs about $1 per year per resident, and you know, it's I know there are other very deserving organizations, but I do want you to know that your money is well spent and well invested. We really utilize it to generate a lot of outside resources.
Well, as you said, you provide this free technical advice to a billion-dollar industry in the county that keeps generating that economic activity. So we like to talk around here about economic multipliers, and the fact that, you know, we're talking $1 a person and leveraging a billion-dollar industry and the employment and other economic activity and sales tax and all that entails is really something we need to be mindful of. So thank you. And if you want to stick around for the next conversation, since you are advisors to Con Ed, we're talking about the PSC and the vegetation. vegetation management plan, you know, feel free to chime in for that discussion. Chris and Stu, why don't you join us at the table?
I probably should clarify our role with Con Ed.
I don't even have minutes.
No, we don't.
You got to take off then.
Okay.
We'll get it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Our role with Con Ed is that we train the supervisors and we teach them about the right way to prune trees and tree health. And then they go out and try to monitor all these contracts that Con Ed has. So we're not actually training the people who are doing the cutting.
Yeah.
We're training the supervisors to tell the people who are doing the cutting not to do it in a bad way.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So as we mentioned before, when Stu and Chris and Marty and I met with the commissioners, they very specifically asked us to provide comments for this case. And Chris, what I would suggest perhaps is right up front, put a sentence saying, you know, based on the suggestion of Commissioner so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so when we met, these are the county's comments on the case. You know, remind them that they solicited these from us and that we're not... So, you know, we've got a few minutes. I don't know if, Chris, if you and Stu want to go through these or how we want to do this. Judy, what's your timing like?
I have an appointments committee at 4.
Okay, why don't you take us through, you know, give us 5 or 10 minutes of your thought behind these, and then what we'll do is it will be beholden to us to get our comments to you by 9 a.m. tomorrow. Is that fair? Will that give you enough time if they're sure to you by 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
That will, and I'll work that in. What these are is, these are, as you can see in this skeleton letter, these are recommendations. There's a total of 39 recommendations, specific recommendations in this case. The PSC, in opening this comment session on its vegetation management rules, later provided 9 questions that they were soliciting comments on. They also would take other input, but they, I guess, were trying to tailor their review by these 9 questions. So, as I had mentioned, maybe not mentioned, but I had been collaborating with one of the community groups and in assisting them with their comments. That was the basis for these various recommendations that are here. They'll be submitting these comments along with other narrative that is not on your letter and photographs as well. You could take a look at this if you like. There are also other comments that other municipalities are submitting. Yorktown and Mount Pleasant and Pleasantville have submitted comments. So just FYI, that's that material. Then I guess to quickly go, you know, and I'll let Stu, jump in as well. But there are 9 questions. As you can see, they're in the bold italicized type. They were looking for comment on industry best practices. They were looking for, number 2, at what point or height. They're even looking for distances or heights where some municipalities have specified distances, some have not, are not municipalities, jurisdictions have specified distances, some have not. The national standard does not specify a numerical standard. Number 3, they're looking for alternative or supplemental practices to help ameliorate the impacts that people have identified in terms of either stormwater runoff, aesthetic buffers that have been removed, noise, and so on, herbicide applications. Number 4 was an interesting proposal. They were looking for unique ways that a municipality could help fund better practices. I guess that's along the theory that a municipality that benefits should help pay for the improved the improvements, and I have some serious concerns about that because the transmission lines are above ground in Westchester. The minute they hit New York City, they go underground. It's much more expensive to install it underground. They're not looking for New York City to be paying those additional costs. So why should they be expecting Westchester communities to pay that? We'll put a comment in to that effect.
Question five is a mitigation question. That group prepared a narrative response. And number six, looking for cost efficiencies. Cleanup number seven was debris. Some of the photos show a lot of debris that was left. Eight is notifications, and you will recall that you did sign a letter of support for a notification legislation. Other jurisdictions, notably Massachusetts and New Jersey, do have notification requirements in their laws. The last question they were seeking input on, I guess it was, how can, you know, self-help? How can landowners help themselves to address these things? So, don't have time to read every single one of these recommendations, but many of them just deal with, the aesthetic issues, the stormwater runoff issues, lack of notification, and a different, in the right-of-way, is the area that Con Edison has authority to remove trees. And I think we're just asking that they do so on a more nuanced basis instead of clearing edge to edge. The PSC actually encourages them to use their full legal rights, so that's contrary to a more managed, nuanced approach. Con Edison has a problem because they have a very limited right-of-way in some areas, and that's a problem from their standpoint as well. When you have general rules that the state has that apply to all of New York State and does not look at individual variations, then some of these problems come up.
We do, most of the problems that we've seen are dealing with the way Con Edison applied the rules. But the PSC is not completely without fault. When you look at their general order in their last case, they use very generic terms. They didn't define some of their terms, and we are going to point that out politely, that those should be addressed and should be clarified.
I would suggest that you attach to this, when you say supporting photographic documentation, give them that full PowerPoint that you prepared for our meeting with the PSC. They were so moved by that. I wouldn't just stick the photos in. That was such a good document. I'd put the whole document
in. We'll put it in as appendix.
Okay. The other question I have is really a procedural question. Should this be a letter from the entire committee? Should it be from you guys? Should it be from me as chair? What do you think the most?
Well, it shouldn't be from the two of us. It should certainly be from the committee, or you can sign it as chair on behalf of the committee. That I defer to.
What do you think, Judy?
I think committee.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So then what we're going to need to do is, if this has to go out Wednesday, we've got to get everybody to sign off or get signatures from all the legislators, from okay. Assistants.
We have a cover. Well, I draft. There's a cover letter here that might be helpful. It just kind of acknowledges the comments, says the problem, and it could be something like, "Please see attached, prepared by our staff," and we're in support of these.
Okay. Yeah. However you want to do that. In fact, maybe if you could give me a copy of that too, because this has a different cover letter. So if you can just give me and Judy a copy of that. We can each look at that, and we'll email you by tomorrow morning our thoughts. And then that'll give you all of tomorrow and Wednesday to pull it together.
Okay. That's this. And just FYI. Thanks. Also, that's one of the industry responses to in this case proceeding. This is by the leading vegetation management company in North America. I think they're Canadian. So they themselves have responded to these nine questions with their perspective. And I see Stuart has the document here that was the basis for the federal rulemaking. They put that together. So there's a different perspective, from the industry.
From the documents that we've already seen filed by the local communities and local activists, we're rather impressed by the quality of what they've put together. They've done a very good job, a couple of the ones that we've seen so far. But we do expect replies from Con Edison and from some other utilities, possibly.
As I had mentioned, there are a lot of utilities that have signed on. There's even utilities in other states that have signed on to be participants in this proceeding, from Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts. So they're looking at this very closely.
Okay. Judy, did you have anything else?
Not.
I would also suggest when you revise this, since this isn't a board letter,
right.
Mention our resolution that the board passed unanimously and attach that as well. Again, even though that was not part of the case, I think, if they're open to this stuff, let's give them everything we've got.
We do want to avoid anything dealing with distribution lines. We want to...
Well, there wasn't anything about distribution.
No, I know, but there were other communities that have sent in things both on distribution and transmission.
Quite frankly, I'm not worried about communities. I'm only worried about this committee and the county. So, we did the resolution. It's on message. You guys did the great PowerPoint. Let's put those two attachments with a cover letter and then, the comments. Does that sound like a plan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, comments? New business, old business? Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Really appreciate
Thank you for
everybody,
the presentation.
All four of you. Motion to close?
Yeah, so moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Thanks.
Sorry about the cuts. We weren't for them.
I know.